The short answer is really that it doesn't matter what scheme you use, and it's subject to these three conditions. And so what people normally do is they just do whatever is convenient. And the exception to that would be if you're calculating an NS matrix element, then it's really true that you want to express that in terms of the physical masses, and if you don't, so then if you don't have a physical renormalization scheme, because these lines are on shell, you can't do anything else really at some level because the graphs you're writing down are infinite. So it's an infinite in a way which is independent of the UV divergences and the IR divergences. It's just that you're putting a line on shell that's not being integrated. So it's not like it's a divergence of an integral. It's just that it's just not well defined. So it's as long as you're not doing the S matrix, you have a lot of freedom what you do because you're just calculating some thing that you're going to use later on for something physical. And as long as you're consistent in your choices, once you arrive at the physical thing, all your choices will drop out. So it won't matter what they were. But normally what's driving things like a choice for the physical or normalization scheme is something like a graph is actually not making any sense if you don't use it. And so in those cases, you have fewer choices. But the S matrix is the only one that really comes to mind as being because of that specific problem of external lines not being forced on shell. For graphs that are on one product reducible. In that case, you really are stuck with a choice for your renormalization condition, but that's the only one I could think of that where you're really forced to do that. And the reason for that in the end is that physical things, the differences between different renormalization schemes are just redefinitions. So for example, if you're talking about the wave function renormalization, it's just a field redefinition that you're doing by changing scheme. And nothing physical cares about that. Intermediate steps do. So if you calculate a correlation function, that will care. But if you actually calculate a physical thing, all those changes of variables just drop out. And so that's why it doesn't really matter so much what they are. But it's just a question of how simple you keep your life in the intermediate steps on the way to your answer.
The pair coupling could be different for different choices of the normalization scheme, right?
Yeah, right. That by definition, they'd be different for different schemes, right? Yeah. But as soon as you as soon as you make a prediction and you're going to test it, you're going to say, well, I need to know a value for E. And so then you'll say, well, how did I measure E? And so there'll be some other observable that you're going to calculate as a function of E, and that's the thing you're going to measure. So maybe that's low energy scattering, or maybe you're measuring an energy level in the quantum Hall effect or something, but you're measuring something. But once you write that observable in terms of E, you solve E for whatever you've measured you have something that you measured, which you're calling the charge. You solve the parameter E as a function of that in that observable. And you plug that into all your other observables. At the level of observables being related to observables, all the choices drop out because then now you're relating physical things to physical things. It's only at the level of parameterizing things in the Lagrangian that things depend on exactly what variables you use. But then that's not physical. It's because that's not an observable.
So all the relative things
kind of. Yeah. So if you think of the goal of physics as being, I take some subset of observables and I think of them as being telling me what my parameters are. And then I predict other observables. At the end of the day, I'm just saying these observables predict these other observables. And that observable inference is independent of what variables you use. But if I parameterize things halfway along the way in terms of this specific electron field and this particular coupling, that'll depend on all my definitions. But what I'm guaranteed is that once I use those definitions to get the physical prediction, all those choices will go away. So then I just use those choices to make my life simple, right? So when we come to regularize things, you could regularize in a really stupid way where you break all the symmetries of your problem and then all your divergences will look crazy, but you can always fix that by renormalizing in a funny way. So for example, if you put in a cutoff or something and you break gauge invariance and you break Lorentz invariance explicitly with the irregularization scheme, you can always undo that by renormalizing in a non, you know, I was only looking at Lorentz invariant terms in the Lagrangian. But if you had broken Lorentz invariance with your regularization scheme, I should write down all the non-Lorentz invariant things I could have written down as well. And they would all have coupling constants, which I would renormalize. And my renormalization condition would be that they're all zero for the renormalized thing. But the bare piece is non-zero because it has to cancel some regularization-dependent thing that you broke the symmetry with. So you can make your life difficult by making your choices that don't, nothing depends on the choices, but you can make your life difficult by making choices that are hard to handle in practice. So it's really it's a convenience thing. So the thing I wanted to, the first thing I wanted to do was the, not this. I wanted to do the definitions of the Zeds in a way that everybody in the rest of the world does, so that you can read everybody else. But it's the same logic. So it's, so we had our Lagrangian was minus 1/4 F mu nu, you know, bear F mu nu bear minus psi bar bear D slash plus M bear psi bear minus like a minus minus I, which is plus I, which is minus IE mu bear psi bar bear mmu psi bear. That was our Lagrangian. And up to now, the split between, we want to write that as being L naught plus L int. And until now, we would have done the split there. We would have said this is quadratic, that's not quadratic. And the error we make is that the parameters in the problem are not the physical ones. So we think of this as the mass because we're used to thinking in, for free theories that would have been the mass. But in an interacting theory, the interactions are shifting the mass, which is not such a stretch that they should do that, because energies depend on interactions, we know that. And so all the parameters are here are proxies for physical things, but they're not numerically the physical thing. And so we have to, at some point, take an observable where we measure the physical thing like the mass or the, you know, say we drop the electron or something, that'll be our observable. And so we calculate that observable in terms of this parameter and we figure out what the physical mass is as a function of it and solve. And that means that we're, and so we had the freedom to do that for these two parameters, and we also had the freedom to redefine these fields because we've chosen these coefficients to be specific for convenience, and we're not guaranteed that that choice for the normalization, the choice of these normalizations shows up as the propagators have poles, and the residue of the pole depends on that choice. So making a conventional choice here is a conventional choice for the residue of the pole of the propagator. And so it might be that once we look at the corrections to a propagator, the residue may not be one anymore, as it would be with this choice. And so we'll have to redefine the field to make the residue one again. And so we have the freedom to, so the things we have the freedom to do are to redefine these parameters and then to redefine the two fields. And so now the convention that everybody in the world uses is that the bare electromagnetic field would be Z3 to the 1/2 times the normalized electromagnetic field. The bare electric field, or electron field, would be Z2 to the minus 1/2, plus 1/2, cybernormalized. And then the electron bare charge is what would, normally that would be, in terms of the renormalized one, that would be Z1, but then there's this conventional factor of Z2 inverse Z3 to the minus 1/2. And you can kind of see the motivation for those choices is, let's say I didn't have one here and I instead had Z3 here. And instead of having one here, I had Z2 here. Then these are the choices. If I define the renormalized field in this way compared to the bare field, then Z3 times A bare would just be A renormalized. Whoops, did I do it backwards? Same difference. So if I, let me write it explicitly. So with these choices, this Lagrangian turns into minus Z3 over 4 F renormalized mu nu, F mu nu renormalized, minus Z2 psi bar renormalized D slash plus M renormalized, and I think it's going to be, I'm going to define M bare to be M renormalized minus delta M. So plus M renormalized minus delta M, I renormalized, and we have minus IE Z1, we'll have Z2 inverse Z3 minus 1/2, and then I'm going to get the factors of those same things again from these three fields, and those will cancel. I'll just get Z1 times renormalized A renormalized mu I bar renormalized And so now,
may I have a question?
Yeah.
What principle imposes the fact that Z1, Z2, Z3 are space independent? Space time independent, actually.
Poincaré invariance in the end of the day. Because the that's the same question as why didn't I write a function here in Lagrangian originally when I wrote it down? Right?
Right.
And if you put any explicit dependence on position in the coefficients, you could do that, but that's making the physics depend on exactly where you are compared to that. So for example, if we imagine this being a background field, so it was a Coulomb field, so it's 1/r, now everything depends on how far you are from the origin, because it depends on how, you know, your interaction with that explicit field would do that. And that's effectively what a function of a position in front of these terms would have done. It would have been like having some background field that you're interacting with, which is varying in space and time.
Right. So the non-trivialistic contest, we have space-time-dependent contest, right?
Well, no. So if you start, so it depends on what your theory is. But if your theory is this one, which is what we're starting with, where these are just numbers, then the claim is that the divergences I'm going to get, or the corrections, the quantum corrections I'm going to get, are not going to ruin the Poincaré invariance that I had. And so I only need to do these transformations with these being constants to account for all these renormalizations that I'm going to want to do.
Thanks.
But if you started off with a theory which had functions of x here, then you'd have to rethink that statement. You'll need more complicated things to fix what's going on. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So now the observation is that the way we're supposed to think about this is that we're thinking that delta m and z1 minus 1 and z2 minus 1 and z3 minus 1, those are all order alpha. So they're perturbatively small. And so when we do this split from L0 to L interaction, what we're supposed to do is take all the things in here that are order alpha and put them into L interaction. And so again, so that means our L naught will be what it was before. It'll be minus 1/4 f mu nu minus psi bar d slash plus m psi. And I'm going to stop writing the renormalizes everywhere, but these are the renormalized fields. And then everything else is in the interaction. And so the interaction is going to be, it'll be what we thought we had anyway. We'll have so I'm going to write the interaction we thought we had the way we thought we had it originally. So it's minus I ER A mu psi R gamma mu psi. I'll leave the R's in here for this the last time, but it'll be the last time. That's what we thought we had, but then really we had a factor of Z1 in it. So we have to add that. So we have minus I ER Z1 minus 1. And then we have these things are z's instead of 1, so we have to add those back in. So we have a minus 1/4 z3 minus 1 Probably I have to be careful about this delta m, right? So I've got to. So far I've taken care of the z2 part of it, but then I also have the delta m. So I should keep the minus or plus z2 delta m. And so now the Feynman rules we can be really precise about, right? So this is the Feynman rule we had before, multiplied by I. The Feynman rule for this was ER gamma mu. MN. if we work our way backwards along the Fermion flow of the line. And now the counter, there's a counter term as well, which is this thing. So it's going to be, and this is so all. So what I'm giving is the Feynman rule for a vertex is always I times 2 pi to the fourth times a delta function for all the momenta times something, call it A, and I'm writing what A is here. And so the counter term, in the same normalization, what will happen is that we're going to get ER Z1 minus 1 gamma mu MN from that one. Yeah, just by this, it's just the ER has been replaced by ER Z plus 1. And then these guys are going to be counterterms. So for this particular counterterm, we have a wavy line with an order alpha. If I have a mu and a nu here, there's a spot here, or a thing here, and what it's going to be given by is so I 2 pi to the fourth delta function of p. If this is p and this is p prime, p minus p prime, that you're not surprised by. And then I want to just give you the sign correctly. So it's the minus. So there's derivatives are turning into IPs, and so I'm going to get an overall minus sign from that. And then I'm going to get it's this minus sign. What I said was true, but there's an IP incoming and IP outgoing, and so really it's a minus sign and I. That actually gives you one. It's this minus sign is the one that I'm writing here. And so we'll have Z3 minus 1. The factor of a fourth is when I write a Feynman rule, there's four different ways. If I it's like when you vary the field, right? I could vary this guy or I could vary this guy, so there's a factor 2 from that. And then if I ask for connecting have I done that right? Oh yeah, I have to write the rest of it. P squared eta mu nu minus p mu p nu. Yeah, so there's a factor of 2 coming from which f. The way you do this is you say, well, so I want to link up a mu with the field here. So then there's two f's I could have connected it to, and then there's a choice of mu versus nu that I could connect the given field to. And so there's a factor 4 coming from that, which cancels that 4. And then there's a similar thing for the Fermion line, Fermion counterterm. And it's going to be, this one and this one will have the same form, and they basically have the structure. There's something independent of momentum and something linear in momentum. And so it'll be, let me get the sign right again. Oh yeah, there's about E Z2 minus 1 times 2 pi to the fourth. Oh, sorry. So minus I, let me write it down and then I'll try and justify it once I've finished, because I, Z2 minus 1 plus M. Plus. And again, we'd have an overall delta of p minus p prime. So the I should be clear, right? So if I, there's the I because it's the I Lagrangian, and then the minus sign came because of the minus sign in the Lagrangian. That's that minus sign. Z2 minus 1 is there. And then this one has a plus sign because that's got a plus sign. Why does that have a plus sign? That has a plus sign because it was that sign with that sign, right? So it's very explicit what these counterterms are when we write the Feynman rules down, and I wanted to not make it sound like it was mysterious. And so when we're going to calculate the vertex function, we're going to calculate a loop here. One of the ambiguities will be when we do our graph, calculate that graph at order alpha, now we have to add to it other graphs, which are, things like this, for example. where I take this counter term. That guy. I should have drawn a picture here for the counter term. And effectively what that's going to mean is that when we evaluate this graph, this is going to give us this Feynman rule. And so anything in this graph which is momentum independent and has the structure of gamma mu is going to have an ambiguous coefficient, because I'll have to, it's going to be multiplied. This will cancel the divergence of it here, and then there'll be some finite piece which we'll have to choose in some way. And that's where the next thing is, how do we choose those things? All right. So there's a very brief aside before we actually do the graph, where I want to talk about propagators, because I was arguing that if you have a graph, we, in order to not have that guy go on shell, we wanted to choose delta M and Z2 in such a way as to make sure that we don't shift the mass. And so I like to kind of go through what do you actually have to do for that. And that's to do with the self-energies. And so I want to define the self-energies. And so I want to, and the self-energies are all about the two-point functions, either two photons or two electrons. And so let me, before I do those two cases, do a scalar field, because that's the one that's stupidly simple. So if, imagine we're calculating the propagator for a scalar field. So in momentum space, it'll be something, and it's the sum of all the graphs in here. Don't know what they are, but there's one line in, one line out, P prime. And so that'll be equal to minus I over 2 pi to the fourth delta 4 of P minus P prime times something. Let's call the something delta. So that's the full honest to God propagator. So, or maybe delta hat for the, this is not the perturbative propagator. This is the honest to God propagator. Whereas this, the Feynman graphs for this would have been, we'd have that. We'd have something like maybe, let's say our interaction is cubic or something. So we could have had something like this. And then we could have something like this. We have something like, and so on. So I've called this round thing, this is the sum of all graphs, all connected graphs, but for a two-point function, they're the same thing. I like to make the distinction between these ones like this that are one particle irreducible, and like this that are one particle irreducible, and this is a one particle reducible. So let's call a square thing sum of all 1pi graphs. And let's call that let's say when we evaluate that, so there's the momentum in, momentum out, it'll be, call that minus I. All right, let me do what I'll call that. I'm going to treat it like it's a vertex. So I'm going to call it I times 2 pi to the fourth times delta to the fourth P minus P prime times, I'll call it pi of P. That's the function we get by doing all these graphs, adding them all up. Now, the idea is that the important idea is that the full thing, the sum of all these graphs, is really, one way to think about it is that it's so the brute force way to think about this is if I take the full thing, I can always think of this as being, if I take all the 1pi graphs, first of all, there's the unperturbed thing, and then we have all the 1pi things. But then something like this is broken up into two 1pi things, so it's going to be plus and writing it this way means that all the 1pi loops are in here now. So I've taken this one and this one and I put them together into here, and in principle if I did this thing twice that would be in here somewhere, and I could do that over and over again. And the important thing is that this is a geometric series essentially, right? So I can think of this as being this is like 1 plus x squared. So that should be 1 over 1 minus x, if I added it all up. Yeah?
So is it like an agreed convention that when you write a square thing, it means the sum of one PI graphs, or is it just something
that's,
you?
That's my definition, yeah.
Oh, that, okay, that's just you. That's yeah. Like something that's common. Or...
The notation of a square, no. It's a,
oh.
But the statement that the total graphs is a sum of a geometric series of the one PI one, that everybody will say that.
No, I just, it was just like a notation.
Yeah, I just wanted to have some way of distinguishing the graphs on the board. And so so writing it that way, so if I kind of write out what that would mean in Feynman speak, the full answer was minus I over 2 pi to the fourth times delta to the four of p minus p prime. That's gonna go, or it's delta hat. Or let's call that one delta of p. So that'll be equal to the Feynman rule for the unperturbed guy. So that'll be minus I 2 pi to the fourth delta to the four p minus p prime. I'll call delta zero the lowest order guy. So that would be, you know, in secret, delta zero is 1 over p squared plus m squared minus I epsilon, if you like, for a scalar. So it's just some simple thing. And so now since I called this thing that, you can kind of see that this next thing is going to be, there'll be a minus I over 2 pi to the fourth twice, because we've got two lines, but then we've got a factor of I 2 pi to the fourth here, so two of them are going to cancel, so we're going to still have this factor. We'll have the delta functions, which are just going to tell us that momentum's conserved, so this factor will still be a common factor. So I can write the correction is going to be, I've already got, I'll have a propagator here, delta naught. I'll have pi of p, then I'll have another propagator, delta naught of p. And then the next term will be, you know, delta naught, pi, delta naught, pi, delta naught, and so on. And so the precise way to make this series go through would be to write this as being as minus I over 2 pi to the fourth, delta of p minus p prime, delta naught, 1 plus stuff. And so that 1 plus stuff is now 1 plus the delta naught out front as I pulled off, so it's pi delta naught plus pi delta naught pi delta naught. And so you can kind of see that's going to be minus I 2 pi to the fourth delta to the fourth p minus p prime delta naught divided by 1 minus pi delta naught. And so let me now write what delta naught is. So this factor here is 1 over p squared plus m squared minus I epsilon times 1 over 1 minus I over p squared minus I, or plus m squared minus I epsilon. And so you can kind of see that's 1 over p squared plus m squared minus pi, the way I've done this, minus I epsilon. So what's happened is that this one particle irreducible guy, you can think of as being shifting it's like a shift in the inverse of the propagator. A more formal way to do that series would have been to say that I'm telling you this because this will be the way we think about things that are matrices. So for the Dirac field and for the photon field, we're not going to just have a series in functions. But another way of writing this would have been, if I strip off the delta function and the 2 pi, I would have had that delta of p, won't write the p's anymore. Delta in this case would have been delta naught plus delta naught pi delta naught plus da da da. Another way of writing that is that that's delta naught plus delta naught pi times delta again, right? Because if I take everything here, I factor it a pi delta naught, then the rest of what's left was what I started with. It's just delta naught plus delta naught pi. So I can solve this for delta naught. Because it says that 1 minus pi, 1 minus delta naught. I'm keeping the order carefully because we're going to be interested when these are matrices. And so delta naught pi times delta will be equal to delta naught. I've done that right, right? Yeah. And so that means that the way we'll get delta is it will be 1 minus delta naught pi inverse matrix acting on delta naught, if we had had a matrix. So, and we will have a matrix for photons and for electrons. But it's the same message that that the one particle irreducible guy is a shift in the pole. So you can kind of see that if pi evaluated when p squared plus m squared is equal to zero, if that's not zero, then what you've done is you've moved where the pole was, because now the pole is no longer p squared plus m squared, because that's not zero. So if you want the pole of the propagator to be at the physical mass m squared, what you have to ask is, so let me finish the sentence. If this is true, then pole of delta is not at p squared plus m squared equals zero. So what we do is we require one of our conditions, the condition that fixes delta m. So delta m fixed by asking that pi of p squared plus m squared equals minus m squared is equal to zero. Right? You have a question? This is just, I'm doing a scalar just because I don't want to do the indices first. I want you to be used to the idea that I can do this. But I'm about to just write down what the answer will be for the photon. And so, but it's it'll look different, but it's basically this logic. And the
question?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
In the Bateson series that you have written, you have not written the symmetry factors, right? In the approach to the Bateson series.
I did. Did I not write the symmetry factors? You're asking.
Yeah. There is symmetry factor. Does it play any role in the geometrics?
I claim that I've written them, and the reason is that's why these factors of four, for example, are there. If we had a real field for a psi, we would have had a factor of a half. And if we had a complex one, we don't need a factor of half, and those are there to cancel the symmetry factors. So for example, in the case of the 1/4 for the photons, if I had a boson, I would have had. So if I had really written a Lagrangian for which this would have been the delta would have been the propagator. Let's say it's real. If I read it as being minus one.
It's freeze. Sorry. The camera is freeze. I didn't see.
Yeah, the camera.
What you are.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, that's good.
Good.
I can see it.
Yeah, good. So the thing is that a half, if I kind of ask, what's the Feynman rule for the propagator and for this vertex function, these factors of two are there to make the symmetry factors, to cancel out the symmetry factors, so that once I'm done, this is the right answer. So you need them when they're identical fields, because then there's two choices of the way a line could connect to the vertex. And you don't need them if you have a complex field, because then there's only one way a field can connect to the vertex, because the thing that destroys the particle is different from the thing that creates it. If you see what I mean?
Yeah. Thank you.
So this will be, in practice, what we'll do is if we were to calculate the vacuum polarization or the self-energy, you don't need to go through and figure out what delta m squared is. All you really do is you ask for this thing, the ambiguous constant in your answer, you ask it to be such that this vanishes. That's a physical, this is a physical scheme. A physical renormalization scheme. And this is the one you would need to not have trouble with these graphs for which these lines would otherwise be on shell. Because when this is zero, you can kind of see why you're fixed. If that's zero, then it says that this looks like 1 over p squared plus m squared. But this is going to zero like p squared plus m squared. So in the end of the day, this graph is no longer a problem, because the vertex, the self-energy is vanishing exactly at the dangerous point. And then what we'll also do is we'll ask the residue to be 1. So if so let's say Yeah, just a sec.
Oh, okay.
So let's say that, that it vanishes at p squared is m squared. So let's say that pi of p is some number times p squared plus m squared plus, you know, order p squared plus m squared squared. So I'm expanding around p squared equals m minus m squared. Then, you know, 1 over p squared plus m squared minus pi is going to be, it'll be 1 over p squared plus m squared, 1 minus c plus order p squared plus m squared to the squared. And so you can kind of see the residue of the pole now depends on this particular coefficient. And so what we'll do is we'll ask the residue to be 1. To not change. And so in this case, that would require that we demand that this particular piece that's linear in p squared plus m squared vanish. And that would be our wave function renormalization condition. That's the requirement. What that says is that you know, we had the freedom to rescale the kinetic term. So in this case, if we had written an overall factor of z in front of this whole thing, we could have got rid of that by scaling phi. So nothing physical depends on z. And so all the residue at the pole is doing is it's giving you something unphysical because it's something which is going to drop out of all physical things. And the way you'd see that explicitly is, remember I told you can get the S matrix by taking a correlation function, looking for putting the external lines on shell such that various intermediate particles are going on shell, and then you divide by some residue of the pole to get the S matrix. So you're always dividing by the residues of the pole, so you might as well make the residues 1 so you don't have to do the division. So this is a convenience. But it's a convenience because this factor never appears in anything physical, because I can remove it essentially by a field redefinition in a Lagrangian. And so that's what we do in practice, is we're going to ask for the propagators to have the pole at the right mass, and the residue there, we want it to be the same one we would have had in the free theory. And those are the two conditions that in practice we're going to use to set things, you know, to choose these counterterms. Yeah. Right. And then that won't fix Z1, but Z1 I'll fix by, and it won't fix delta M. So the only thing left at that point will be the, or sorry, it will fix delta M because that's the pole not changing. But it won't tell you Z1, and that'll be the choice. You have to have some physical thing that defines what your charge was. And once you tell me what that is, I can tell you what Z1 is. Okay. So now the one last thing I want to do is for ENM, what's the inverse matrix story? And let me just write it down. Oh goodness, yeah, empty board. So what we'll do is for the Dirac field,
I have a question. So if you look at this scalar field, so even for a classical Lagrangian, we would have some anomalous dimensions for the fields, right? Which is kind of weird. Like even for some classical field, you have, because anomalous dimensions are basically some quantum processes.
When you say anomalous dimensions, what do you mean here?
Like the anomalous dimensions of these fields get due to these Z2 and Z1.
Well, this is not directly the anomalous dimension. I think where you're headed is that
when the fields get renormalized.
Yeah, but I think what you have in mind there is that if I scale, it will be true that once I actually write what Z is as a function of cutoff, then if I change scale, that's like changing the cutoff. So if I integrate out a bunch of physics from high scales to some lower cutoff, then Z will acquire a scale dependence. And so this redefinition, the scale dependence of Z will then give you the anomalous dimension that you're thinking about. But so far that information is not here. Just this redefinition doesn't say anything about anomalous dimensions because there's no scale in it yet.
But like when we write our Hamiltonian, like H naught and H interaction, right?
Yeah.
So I'm saying like even in the absence of interaction Hamiltonian, we do have the renormalization scheme, right? We do need to care about that, right? It's not.
Well, if you don't have, the thing is, if you don't have any interactions, then alpha zero, and then I can't remember what I wrote it here, but these are all order alpha. So then now these are all zero, and so now z is one, and so then you don't need them. So it's only they're only there because the if you had a free theory, the m in the Lagrangian was the mass, so you're happy with that. But if you have the interacting theory, then it's at that point the parameter in the Lagrangian is not the physical mass, and so then you need to have these redefinitions around. Yeah, it's because the interaction is there that it's making the parameter not the physical value that you think it was. So for the Dirac field, what we're going to do is we'll define, you know, if in conventions where the free Dirac field would have been minus I p slash plus m over p squared plus m squared, so where I've got rid of all the other factors, then if that's S naught, then we'll define S inverse to be I p slash plus m, because that's what this was the inverse of, minus sigma p. And so this is a Dirac matrix. And what we'll ask is, we'll ask that sigma at when I p slash is equal to m, or sorry, p slash is equal to I m, we want that to vanish. That'll be the analog of the condition that I probably on the board here I covered, that keeps the poles from moving. And then we'll ask the derivative of this thing at that point to satisfy it to be zero, so that we don't shift the residue. And then for the photon is the more interesting one, right? So for the photon, let's imagine that that our unperturbed propagator is is eta mu nu, or sorry, 1 over p squared minus I epsilon times eta mu nu. And I won't do alpha mu q nu just to make my life simple. I'll choose alpha to be proportional to q, because that's commonly what you get in a covariant gauge. So let's take the unperturbed propagator to have that form, which would be true in basically any covariant gauge you're going to run into in regular life. So this includes Feynman gauge, includes Landau gauge, includes unitary gauge. Unitary gauge doesn't really apply in the case of a photon, but so this is broad enough that it's all you need to know. And so if I go through the same argument about the matrix for the propagator, the full propagator. So again, I define the square thing. I call that I times 2 pi to the fourth times pi mu nu of p, delta to the fourth p minus p prime. And I wish that board would stay down.
That feels like a race against the clock.
Yeah, well, it's kind of the thing. It's probably a brush should be just enough weight to keep it down, and there's no ledge on it, unfortunately. I could put it there, but then what'll happen is that now that brush is gone.
I mean, that board is a proof that ripple sim gravity exists.
Dark energy in your everyday life, right?
Yeah.
So the thing I want to tell, so what I want to do is I want to write down what would the analog of S be, not the inverse, in terms of delta naught and pi. And the thing is that we know that gauge invariance says that this has to be transverse. So I can also write pi mu nu as p squared eta mu nu minus p mu p nu times pi of p squared. So the only function, there's only a function of p squared in here. There's not a tensor's worth of functions, because gauge invariance is forcing me to have that tensor structure. And so what I want to show you how, before, when the class ends, don't let me forget that brush is there. So you just go through the exercise of a matrix inverse. So what will happen if the full propagator, in that case, is going to be, what you do is you just take a general tensor. So take it to be something proportional to eta mu nu, something proportional to p mu, p nu, and then solve for the coefficients. I'm just going to tell you what the answer turns out to be. So it's eta mu nu over p squared minus I epsilon times 1 minus pi of p squared plus p mu p nu times alpha over p squared minus pi of p squared divided by 1 minus pi p squared times 1 over p to the 4th. There's something funny with that. Oh, yes. So I was wondering about the dimensions of that, right? It looks funny because there's a 1 over p squared and there's a 1 over p to the 4th, and pi is dimensionless. It's because alpha has dimensions of 1 over mass squared for this to be dimensionally correct. So this whole square bracket is 1 over mass to the 4th, and the alpha is the missing thing. So again, it's true that you can kind of see that as long as, if you want the pole to be p squared equals 0, so as long as pi of p squared is regular at p squared equals 0, then the pole will be here. So if I multiply this through, right, this becomes p squared minus p squared pi minus I epsilon. So as long as this is p squared pi, as long as that's finite, as long as pi is finite at p squared equals 0, p squared pi is going to go to 0. And so the pole is still at p squared equals 0. Pole remains at p squared equals 0. And so that's kind of how you see that. You might have worried that when we did the electromagnetic field, the other fields, you needed to choose the mass counter term to make the pole at the right place, and then we choose the rest to make the residue one. You might have worried, why didn't we have two things for the photon? And that's why, is that as long as pi is regular, you don't have to worry about the pole. The pole stays there, and it's got that property because of the fact that gauge invariance forces us to have this property, and that's making everything automatically want to be at p squared equals 0. Well, because one of the things that we've been doing, one of the whenever we contract p mu on any fermion line, we got zero. So a special case would be to do it for this vertex. That has to be zero. So then it's built out of p. This is the most general tensor that's Lorentz invariant that can be satisfied that. So that's, and gauge invariance is what the current conservation is what gave us that. That's the first thing. So then what we'll do is we'll choose pi to not ruin the residue. And so you can kind of see that what we're going to ask is that we'll ask for pi at p squared equals 0 to be 0. And that will keep the residue from changing. So that'll be our one condition. Unity. So we don't have too many conditions. We only have as many conditions as we're allowed to have. And here I lied to you, really, because this makes it sound like it's impossible to ever give the photon a mass, and that's false. And the loophole that spontaneous symmetry breaking threads is, if pi has a pole at p squared equals 0, then this could be a constant, and then you'd have a pole at a non-zero value of momentum, and that would be where your mass came from. And so spontaneous symmetry breaking, which is how you would give the photon a mass, is corresponds to when pi of p squared goes like something over p squared plus order one as p squared goes to zero. And the way you would see that, if you had a scalar field, a Goldstone boson or something that went with the breaking of the symmetry, is that you would have a mixing graph between the photon and the Goldstone boson, and then now you can draw a graph like this that contributes to the vacuum polarization, but where you've got a massless photon scalar line in here, which goes like 1 over q squared. And so that would be how you'd see that's one way to see you could get a pole. And so it's generically true, and in QED it'll be true that pi is not singular at p squared equals 0. It can happen, and when it does, that would shift the pole. Good. So with that, in the last half an hour, now we can calculate something. All right, so let's do that. I've carefully marked all the pieces that I want to use here. Here we go. So, let's compute this matrix element we talked about. So we have an electron, electromagnetic current, an electron. And so what do we know about it? So we know that so this is going to be, electron out, something will happen, electron in. And so the first thing we'll do is say, well, what does this have to look like? So is there some general thing we can say about it? And so if we can imagine evaluating that, that's going to be, we're going to get a Feynman rule where the external line will be a U bar of P. There'll be a, 2 pi to the fourth, 2 pi cubed, twice the energy. And I'm not going to write those factors. So let's just say let's write them. So this is going to be, I'll just take the Feynman rule of the external line. We got that divided by square root of 2 pi cubed times twice the energy. And then we have some matrix with an index mu. And then we have u of, let's imagine that we're working back along the line. So this would be p. This is p prime. You have p prime, square root of 2 pi cubed, or twice the energy. Then we'll have, yeah?
In the right, the sigma prime, right?
Thank you, yeah. And that's also in here. Oh, sorry, in here. And then I'm thinking of this as being like a vertex. You can think of the photon is going to attach here. It's like having a photon line where I amputate the external line, but there's like an operator in here to which the Feynman rules will attach, because this is psi bar gamma mu psi. And so I'll write that here with a mu. So we know that there's a momentum. If I put a position dependence here, I could Fourier transform, and there's a momentum that could go in here. So the momentum q here would be equal to, by momentum conservation, it would be p prime minus p. And so if I think of that as a vertex, I'm going to normalize it with an I 2 pi to the fourth, delta to the fourth of p prime minus p minus q. And this m, it's a Dirac matrix with an index, and it depends on p, p prime, and q. So the first thing we can ask is, what's the most general thing that could be there? Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, okay, that might not matter, but Shouldn't the momentum arrows be consistent with the fermion arrows direction?
No, it actually does matter, and it's not what. Because the thing is the numerator of the propagator is linear in momentum, yeah. So you change the sign, it actually matters.
Okay.
And if you look carefully at when I did the Feynman rules, the rule was always you're going backwards along the fermion line, and the momentum was flowing the other direction.
Okay.
When I gave it to you, so it's good you flagged that, because that's a sign that can bother you sometimes.
Yeah.
All right, so the thing is, this is some Dirac matrix, so the question is...
For that, like, what sign should you worry about then? What is...
Oh, he's saying when I write minus I p slash plus m over p squared plus m squared, which way was the momentum going?
It's going in the opposite way.
And I'm always working... This was also a Dirac matrix, and it was if I write the Dirac indices, A on the left and B on the right... The one that was A and the one that was B was going backwards. If the arrow was showing me where the fermion number went, then the A the A B matrices, I'm writing them going backwards along the line. And so this is again also has this is something sandwiched between two spinners. So it's got two Dirac matrices. So I can write it as one of the basis things, right? It's a linear combination. So it's something. Let me just write question mark times 1 plus question mark times gamma 5 plus question mark times gamma mu plus question mark times gamma 5 gamma mu plus question mark times gamma mu nu. And I have to get the indices to work right because it's got to be consistent, a consistent Lorentz tensor. So, but I could write here, I could write, you know, P mu, or I could write P prime mu, or maybe Q mu. And here I could do the same thing, you know, P mu, P prime mu, Q mu. Here I could write down one, or some function of for all of these things, I could have some function of P squared and P prime squared and Q squared. So those are all Lorentz invariant. But those guys, the P squared is equal to minus M squared, because that's actually the mass, that's the momentum of a particle. And P prime squared is equal to minus M squared. So if I think of dynamical variables, really Q squared is the only invariant thing I have. So Q squared is the only function I could have, but every one of these things could have a function of Q squared appearing in front of it. P times Q is Q squared, right? It's because Q squared is basically P dot P prime, because P and P prime are the only independent things, and that's the only Lorentz invariant thing you can make, because those guys are numbers. Yeah, and then now Q times P is just going to be a linear combination of these numbers again. So the thing is, if we demand that this thing is parity invariant, and we demand that, you know, these spinners, they satisfy, you know, I P slash plus M on them is a U of P that's equal to zero. So if I take, whenever I have a, supposing I looked at a term here like I had P slash here, then if P slash acts to the left on somebody, that's going to be something I can turn into a mass, so I don't have to think of that as independent. And if I have it on a P slash prime on the right, I can do the same thing. And so I can get rid of a whole bunch of terms that way. And so if I do all those things, let me write down what's left. So what's going in here is just parity invariants and Lorentz invariants. And I'm not trying to track masses. So every time I can get rid of something using this or P squared plus M squared, I don't count that as something as independent because that's really just a number. And I'm not going to track the M dependence. So the most general thing we can have is, and this is a good exercise to go through because it's not that hard, but you just have to be exhaustive. So we could have had, so mu could have been gamma mu times some function of Q squared. And we could have minus I over 2M P plus P prime mu times a function G of Q squared. And then we could have plus I over 2M times Q mu times another function of Q squared. And that's all that's allowed by these two things. So if I ask things to be parity, I want this to be a vector, not an axial vector, is what the, and gamma 5 is the thing that's giving me parity, funny parity properties, the axial vector parity properties. So that's what kind of gets rid of the gamma 5s. And then Lorentz invariance is what's left, and throwing away the things that are zero when I use P slash is equal to IM, and P squared plus M squared is zero. That's good. But we also know that Q mu mu has to vanish, because that's the reward identity story, that the Q mu connected on any fermion line is going to give us zero. And so this satisfies that, because Q slash U bar Q slash U is equal to zero, because Q slash is P slash minus, or P prime slash minus P slash. And the P slash or the P prime slash hits one of the U's and gives you an M and then gives you zero. So this one's okay. This one's also okay, because Q mu times P plus P prime mu is basically, this is P prime minus P, so this is P squared minus P prime squared, which is zero. But this one gets killed. So the fact that this is a conserved current says that there's only two functions in this thing. So before we evaluate anything, all we can hope to learn is what these two functions are. Those functions are called form factors. And when we took the, if we took the original Lagrangian that we started with, you know, if we just asked what was the original vertex we had, know, if we took this vertex, that was the proportional to u bar gamma mu u. So you can kind of see that the free electron corresponds to f of q squared is equal to 1 and g of q squared is equal to 0. Because this is, I keep 1 and I throw that away. The m's are there because on dimensional grounds, I want f and g to be dimensionless, so it's just convention. And the 2's and the i's are there because that's going to make the things what we're going to look at later on real, so those are all conventional. So it's with this choice, these are the conventions that people would normally use, and this is the before we turn interactions on, we should be expecting that when we calculate f as a function, it'll be 1 plus order alpha stuff, and g will be order alpha stuff, and there won't be any 1 in it. That's the thing. And the physical interpretation of these things we can also look at, because if we take an interaction Hamiltonian to be minus j dot a, or an a where b is equal to, you know, grad cross a, so take some constant field, we can ask what's the energy of our electron. We can ask what's the energy shift, expectation value of h interaction in perturbation theory due to this, and we can ask, you know, so as a function of the field, how does the energy shift? And we can use that to determine what the how some of the properties of F and G are related to physical things like charges and magnetic moments. So this is what we would do. We would do this for the magnetic moment, and we could also just take a Coulomb field and turn it on and ask, what does J0 do? So we could also look at or H interaction proportional to, you know, J0 A0, which is the Coulomb interaction. And this is where you'd read off the charge normally, because you'd look at scattering like you guys do for Mott scattering, and you'd say, well, I can figure out what the charge would have been by comparing the measured Mott scattering cross-section with the prediction you guys have for as a function of E. And this is the thing that'll give us the magnetic moment, because you'd ask for this to be minus something dot B, and then something will be the magnetic moment. So I won't do the, you know, in the 20 minutes, I won't do so what you do is you take this expectation value we've got here, and we take P and P prime to be essentially the same. So it's you're making the transfer Q go to zero, essentially. And in that limit that Q squared is going to zero, then you should expect the values of these functions at Q squared equals zero to be given by the charge and electric and the magnetic moment of the electron. And let me just tell you what the answer is. So the upshot is that the charge, you won't be surprised by the charge. The charge electron is going to be just given by, you know, minus E times F of zero. So if F of zero were 1, it would be minus E. And this will be the renormalized charge. And the magnetic moment is going to be, here I want to get the units right. There's a factor of 2, which is historical. Oh, I'm sorry, I lied to you. I lied to you. Yeah, it's F of 0 plus G of 0. And that's also consistent with G being 0 and F being 1. Then the magnetic moment is it's a charge over 2m times F of zero. So this is the magnetic moment as the vector is this thing times the spin as a vector. And so so you know that F of zero plus G of zero is equal to 1. That has to be true because we know that this is, if that's the renormalized charge, that's what we meant by renormalized charge. So this is how we're going to choose our renormalization condition for the vertex function. So Z1 will be fixed by requiring this to be true. And that's a choice for f of zero, because that's f of zero is the thing that has no momentum in it. And so that's the thing that could have diverged in that graph. And so that's where the divergences will be. And we'll fix that by determining f of zero to satisfy this, because that makes the charge the physical charge that we would measure in Coulomb scattering, say. And then g is whatever it is. And this says that this is going to be now q over 2m 1 minus g of zero. And so this is the naive Dirac magnetic moment that you would have had in the Dirac equation, because that's the case, the Dirac equation is the case where g was zero and f was one. And so g of zero is the anomalous magnetic moment. And and the good thing is that because it's got a momentum in it, it's going to be ultraviolet finite. So it doesn't matter how we do the divergences, that'll all be in here. And it's actually very clean. Once we've imposed this renormalization condition, the thing we're going to calculate is just going to be really, it doesn't matter how we regularize anything.
So the renormalization condition basically constrains the, or relates the finite and the divergent part?
Well, what will happen is that when we just calculate the graph that we're going to calculate, there will be a divergent part, and then we'll have a counter term. And so this thing, f of zero, will turn out to be the counter term plus the divergent part, and then all the momentum dependent stuff. So anything that depends on q squared will be finite, and anything in here will be finite.
And so we want to keep a track of finite terms too, right? That's why we define it like this.
Yeah, well, so the only thing that's ambiguous is the q squared independent piece of this, and then the finite part of that is ambiguous too. And so the divergences we'll choose to cancel, but then the way we'll fix the finite part is we'll demand this is true, because we want this to be the physical charge, which we could have measured in Coulomb scattering. So now we calculate it. So we have to evaluate this plus the counterterm graphs, but we don't have to. What I'll just do is, rather than counterterm graphs, whenever I have f of zero, I'll just choose the counterterm to be whatever I have to do to make the zero part vanish. And it's normally actually the best way to do these things is to have me do it in my head, and it's the thing that I'm going to get wrong, given that we only have 15 minutes. So I'm going to normalize this to be. I'm going to call this minus the charge. That would be plus E for an electron, times 2 pi to the fourth times lambda mu of P and P prime. So the thing we called gamma in the assignment would have been this plus the thing with the thing we got had at tree level, the plus E times gamma mu. So this is the correction to the vertex. And so then gamma mu is going to be, so this thing is going to be equal to, we'll have, it's got a loop, so we'll have the fermion that's going that way, P is going in here, P prime is coming out of there, Q is here, let's say K goes around the loop. So in here what we'll have is we'll have P minus K, and in here we'll have, going that way, we'll have P prime plus K. This will be A minus P prime, right? A goes in, P prime goes out. This would be, K, going that way would be K minus P prime, so going that way would be P prime minus K. Yeah. So the fermion is going that way, and the momentum is going that way. And this is mu, and this is A and B. So this is lambda AB. Thank you. Yeah. So this is now the integral. We have a loop integral, so we have integral d4k. We have the vertex, which is going to be minus q times 2 pi to the fourth times gamma mu. Then we have the propagator, which is minus I over 2 pi to the fourth is minus I p slash minus k slash plus m over. Now I can see in my graph I did it the opposite direction. I had P prime here. Just to make it, let me just do that just because otherwise everything's gonna look funny to you. That's P prime minus K. And we have the vertex again, so it's minus Q 2 pi to the fourth gamma rho. And we have right, mu. Then we have minus I over 2 pi to the fourth times the photon propagator, 1 over a squared minus I epsilon. I'm missing a propagator. What happened? Here, yeah. Oh, I kind of, since I was going to continue, let me just do it here. So you're supposed to read this wrapped around. And so we can write from that that lambda mu is equal to I times q squared over 2 pi to the fourth times an integral d4k of a numerator n mu divided by a denominator. And let me write what those are. I'll write how they started off looking, and then I'll write where they go. So n mu, or d is the simplest one. D is just product of all the things we had here. P minus k squared plus m squared. P prime minus k squared plus m squared. I'm not writing the I epsilons, but they're there, k squared. And n mu is, starts off being gamma mu minus I p slash prime minus k slash plus m gamma mu minus I p slash minus k slash plus m. Sorry, I garbled up my gamma matrices here. That was a row. Then there should have been, I should have had a gamma rho propagator gamma mu propagator gamma rho. So I forgot the gamma mu. The minus IQ is here already, so I don't have to rewrite it. And this is gamma rho. So I have gamma rho, gamma mu, gamma rho. Is that right? Yes. So now, the first thing you do is you start moving p slashes to the right and p slash primes to the left so that we can have them kill the Dirac matrix. And so once you've done that, this simplifies a little bit, and I'm going to just tell you what it turns out to be. And I encourage you to do this yourself. P prime minus k dot p minus k m mu plus 4 I m a mu minus 4 p plus p prime mu. The utility of this is we want to make it look like this, right? We want to have the same structure. So I want to write it with just less, two or less gamma matrices times k slash plus 2 gamma mu times k squared plus 4 a mu k slash. So now what do we do? The integral diverges because it's a d4k. The denominator has a total of 2, 4, 6 k's in it. So it looks like that's converging, unless we have two powers of k in the numerator, and we do, right? We have, there's one here and there's one here. So this is going to diverge logarithmically like we thought. So we're going to have to regularize it. And so there's two steps here, three steps here, actually. The first step is we're going to Wick rotate, which is to say we'd like to do is to do an integral If I put in the minus I epsilons, it's kind of a much, it'd be much easier to do an integral, do the integrals here if we were doing them in Euclidean space. And the energy integral we're doing when we do this integral d4k has a pole for positive frequencies below the axis and negative frequencies above the axis. And we're integrating like that. So what we can do in the energy plane, or the k0 plane, is we can rotate the contour that way. And we avoid the poles, and you can check that infinity of the arc, it converges. So that ultimately we're going to end up integrating like that. And so effectively that means that it's going to be convenient to take k0 and write it being I k4. Which is the Euclidean K, where it's I rather than minus I because we rotated that way. And so when we do that, we're going to, for d4k is going to turn into I times d4k Euclidean. And all our dot products are going to be now Euclidean dot products because we're using the right metric. They're not going to be minus dot products because we're not using the wrong metric. Okay. That's the first thing. So now we're doing a Euclidean integral. Now it would be nice, we have to regularize it, and we're going to use dimensional regularization. And I told you there was rules for regularization, and the rules are basically this, that the rule is that whatever my regularization is, if I regularize a convergent integral, I should get what the integral is equal to. So the idea is you're always putting a regularization is I'm going to calculate I won't do the integral I want to do. I'll put a parameter into the integral such that the integral converges. And then the parameter, I'll choose to go to some place. So if I turn off the parameter, I'll go back to what I had, but I'll do my manipulations with the parameter not zero and in such a way that everything is finite and I can check if I can change the order of integrals and everything converges and things. And then when I get to the answer, I'll then go to take the parameter to zero. But I won't do that until I've canceled the divergence. And so when I've identified something where I've renormalized it, I know that it's safe to take the parameter to zero, and then I'll do it. So what you ask for a regularization is a good regularization. I thought my number was on that one. Good regularization satisfies that if I regulate a convergent integral, I get the answer. The other thing you wanted to do is there's three things that I'm thinking there's only. The main other one is that if I regulate, the two integrals, so integral of A plus an integral of B, let's say, I want it to be linear. So I want this to be, that's what it is. So I want this to be the regulator for the integral of A plus the regulator for the integral of B. So it's got to be linear in that sense.
And symmetry is another criteria.
Sorry?
You don't want symmetry is another criteria of regularization.
Here I want to say, independent of symmetries, what you have to have be true. If these things are true, and I think I'm forgetting one, but these are the main ones. The point of this is that if I have any two regularization schemes, it won't matter how I regularize things, because what I know in the end of the day is I've got a bunch of counterterms around. Those counterterms are also integrals. If I express a condition like this in terms of the counterterms in my graphs, this is going to say counterterm equals some integral, which is diverging, which will be regulated. So in the end of the day, once I've grouped things together and I've imposed my regularization, my renormalization conditions, I'm going to get sums of differences of diverging graphs. And as long as the regularization of the sum is the sum of the regularizations, so I'm going to get this. So I can write them as this, but I know that they've been designed so that when I add them together, I get something which is finite because that's what the counterterm was designed to do. And then this says I get the right answer. I get the answer of the convergent answer that I'm supposed to get. So as long as you've got something which is satisfying these two properties, it doesn't matter how you do it. But then given that, now you want to make the choice that Afshin was saying. So you want to make your choice, the one that makes your life easy, and that's what dimensional regularization is almost always the one, because it preserves as many symmetries as you could hope to preserve. And so the idea let me just do it for one example in the 4 minutes that are relating. The example was, oh, come on, where did I hide you? I carefully identified all these places that I wanted to look at. Here we are. Let's take the example of so I'm going to write down something which I wrote down before, but I'd be just so I don't have to come back here and get it again. So the area of an n-sphere, or a sphere of unit radius in n space dimensions, Euclidean dimensions, is 2 pi to the n over 2 divided by gamma over n over 2. Times the radius to the power, but this is a unit sphere. I'm going to use that later on. So in dimensional regularization, let's say we have an integral of the form the integral d4k of k, let me say p, because that's what I've got written in my notes here, p squared to some power, call it a, divided by p squared plus some other thing, which could be some external momenta, could be a mass, could be anything, minus I epsilon to the b. We don't quite have that because we don't have just squares, but we'll fix that with the Feynman reparameterization trick in a second. And we're going to imagine that this thing, this diverges in the UV if 4 plus 2a is greater than or equal to 2b. So what we'll do is, the first thing we'll do is we'll go to Euclidean space, so we won't have to worry about that. We'll have a factor of I here. So the integral is called, that's I, it depends on a squared. So we'll go to Euclidean space, and now these are all Euclidean. Let's do that integral. And then the idea for dimensional regularization, you're gonna fight me on that one. I didn't want to do that. Let me go here.
Oh, can we just see the last four?
Yeah, I hope you. I wish you could, but it's. Where did the other brush go? It fell down. I thought.
Yeah.
Did I already pick it up? Oh yes, I did. Yeah. Can everybody see this? Yeah.
Yeah, the camera, that's not.
Yeah, that's okay. So now what we're going to do is let's do this in D dimension. So let's imagine, so the I will be, our regularization will do this in D dimensions, DDK. We have P squared to the A divided by P squared plus A squared to the B. This is now Euclidean. P. And the idea is, if I just think of D as being some complex number, I can, if I make D sufficiently negative, I can make this thing converge. And so, how are you going to define that for something negative? So what we'll do is, the way I've written it, there's no, the angles are easy to do here. The angles are just going to be this. It's going to be the solid angle in n dimensions. So this will be I times S. D, which is over there, times the integral from 0 to infinity of dE to the d minus 1 dPe times, let me not write the e's anymore, p squared to the a over p squared plus a squared to the b. And so it's, you can't stop yourself from writing this as dp squared, p squared to the d minus 1 over 2 divided by 2. And now the observation is that the beta, Euler's beta function, this integral you can do as for any complex thing because it's Euler's beta function. So we're going to use that integral from 0 to infinity dx of x to the m divided by x plus y to the n. That's equal to y to the m minus n plus 1 gamma of m plus 1 gamma of n minus m minus 1 divided by gamma of n. So that defines this integral for d sufficiently negative, where I just read off the powers from here. And it's not an analytic continuation, because we're defining this thing. This is defined for integer d, and you can't uniquely analytically continue from the integers. You can uniquely continue from a open set, but not from poles. But because it doesn't matter what we do, as long as it satisfies those properties, which this does, this is what our definition will be. And so the way that we see that the divergence happen is that when, and the choices for which, you know, d, so the condition for this to converge, or I guess here we didn't have it, but here, condition for this to converge is that we had to have d minus 1 plus 1, because it's just d, yeah, d plus 2a minus 2b had to be less than 0. That's the condition for convergence. So we'll imagine that we're going to make d complex, and we'll make it as satisfy this. We do our integral, we do whatever we want, we get an answer. And then the way that the divergence will come back to us when d goes to 4 is that these gamma matrices, gamma of z as a pole, has simple poles, but only at negative integers. You know, 0 and negative integers, 0, minus 1, minus 2, and so on. And so the divergence will show up as a pole in d minus 4 in the answer. So we look for poles of 1 over d minus 4. And those are the things we'll subtract, yada, yada, yada. We do all that, and then this will just take 2 seconds to cut to the chase. The remaining thing is, how do we take the thing that we have here? How do we take this, which is an integral here, and write it in the form of the dimensional regularization thing we want to do? It, you know, the problem is that the denominator doesn't have this, it's not the structure of k squared plus something. But we can make it that way with the Feynman trick, right? So that Feynman trick that you proved in the assignment. Which I hope it's even true. Yeah. let me show you the version we're going to use here.
By the way, double check there. In Weinberg's book, there's the exact same form.
As mine?
Yeah.
So he's probably right this time. Sorry. Let me just. I just want to show you this one. We're just so close to the answer. To the answer here. Let me just. Where are we? Blah, blah, blah. Here we go. Yeah. All right, so in the example that we're doing now, the way we use the trick is, let's get rid of this one. The way we use the trick is we write 1 over d, which is the problem child. We write that as 2 times the integral from 0 to 1 dx, integral from 0 to x dy of curly bracket.
Camera's not moving.
Sorry?
Camera's not moving.
Camera! Hello. See, it's probably true that we're past the time now, and so those guys have a job, so they may not be able to follow.
Yeah,
So maybe what I'll do is I'll try and stay on that board. Is anyone still at home? Never mind. Sorry, guys. All right, so we're just about done here. So it starts off being, you know, p minus k squared plus m squared times y plus p prime minus k squared plus m squared times x minus y plus k squared times 1 minus x, curly bracket to the minus 3. That's our identity for n equals 3. And then if you expand this out, that's 2 times the integral 0 to 1 dx, 0 to x dy. There's a change of variables we can do that makes this nice. So that's we can write this as k minus p prime y minus p x minus y squared plus a squared minus I epsilon minus 3, where a squared is just minus p prime y plus p x minus y squared. And so what we do is we do the Feynman trick by writing the denominator this way. We change variables from k to this, and then that shifts a whole bunch of things in n, because now k gets shifted to have a bunch of x's in it. But then once we've done that, we've got polynomials of momenta in the numerator, and the denominator has the form we want. And the polynomials of momenta in the numerator, because this is a Ransom invariant regularization scheme, when you do the integrals over the k's, they have to turn into A to mu nu's and things. And so you can just read off each term in the numerator and apply that formula repeatedly to each term. Thus settles, you identify the piece which is proportional to p mu. There's a piece like this which is proportional to p plus p prime, but there's going to be other terms too when we do that shift, and you do everything, and the answer is g of q squared is equal to minus 2i times q, the charge squared, times, I don't know why I didn't write this as this is minus 16i q squared times m squared over 2 pi to the fourth times an integral 0 to 1 dx, integral 0 to x dy this is an 8. And there's not a minus sign. There's not an I, because I was reading the wrong thing. There's a pi squared. This is coming from the angular integral. And then we have y, 1 plus x minus x, divided by m squared x squared plus q squared y x minus y squared. No, linear. That should be dimensionless. It is. Good. And so that's what it is as a function of q squared. It's completely ultraviolet finite because we were guaranteed that was going to be true. And so we didn't have to arrange that. So once we dimensionally regularized, we were guaranteed that the pole was not going to appear here. It's going to appear in f of 0. But in particular, g of 0, which is what we want for the anomalous magnetic moment, you can stick in q squared equals 0 here. And that just becomes, I won't even try and do it in my head because I'll get it wrong. Becomes minus q squared over 8 pi squared. So for an electron, that's minus alpha over 2 pi. And so the anomalous magnetic moment, what they call g minus 2 is minus 2 times g of 0, just because historically, you know, they wanted to be q over m, or that you want to cancel the 2 and it's in the spin, and so that you compare that 1 minus g to 2, and that's, we're predicting, you know, this answer is giving us alpha over pi plus order alpha squared. And so then one last thought is, you know, if you can continue down the list, the 1 minus g of 0, if we went to higher order, what we would have found is that that's equal to 1 plus alpha over 2 pi plus alpha squared over pi squared. Next term turns out to be 197 over 144 on symmetry grounds plus pi squared over 12 plus 3 quarters the zeta of 3, the Riemann zeta function, minus pi squared over 2 log 2. That's the big term. And this whole thing is, this is basically minus 0.328. It's this whole thing is 1.00115639. And the experiment is 1.00115965673, and the error being that. And this is back in the 80s. So it's better now. And so it's that's just marvelous, right? That you just do some crappy little calculation like this, and it just nails this energy associated with magnetic field. So people often complain that quantum field theories haven't been proven to exist mathematically, and you're going to compare it to a decimal experiment like that. I don't care. it's really remarkable. And there's a story. You can do the same thing for the muon, and you might have thought the way the story I've told you so far, you should get the same answer because the mass wasn't here appearing here. And that's wrong, and that's because for the muon, you know, because we've scaled out the overall 1 over mass that has to be there for the magnetic moment. Where's the chalk? The thing that happens at this order is, you know, that's kind of one more loop than we were doing. If you have a muon here, we had a photon. Now you can have a loop of electrons, if you like. And if we could have had the same thing here, if we had electrons, we could have had a muon here. But this is that's you know what we call pi of q squared, right? That's the vacuum polarization. And when we do this for an electron, if we do the case where we have electrons and we put muons in here, the characteristic scale in here is the muon mass, and we're interested in an energy down at the electron mass. So we're basically interested in pi of q squared almost at zero, which our normalization condition is that that's zero. So this is something which is suppressed by, you know, the electron mass divided by the muon mass to some power. Whereas if we do this for muons with electrons inside here, it's no longer true, because then we're looking at momentum flow through here, which is large compared to electron mass, and then this could be some complicated thing. So because of that, the muon expression is not quite the same. It's written down here, but it doesn't matter. And it also agrees very well, although there is this discrepancy that you mentioned that has recently come up. But they're kind of farther down the list here than just these. So that's a good place to stop. Sorry I ran late.